Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the ICON Research Center at the University of Warwick. This is episode 29, where we're discussing our 7th Journal of Management Studies classic, The Business School, A Problem in Organizational Design by Herbert Simon. To get the text and for more information, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. My name is Dimitris, coming to you from Birmingham in the United Kingdom.
And this is Tom, coming to you from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States.
And this is Denise Rousseau from Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Welcome, Denise. We are so happy to have you with us today.
Thank you.
So Denise wrote one of the accompanying articles to the to Herbert Simon's Journal of Management Studies classic. And so we're just amazingly pleased that she is with us to discuss this episode that I think we've been inadvertently building towards for a while now. So this is very, very exciting. Just a few words about Denise. You should know her from her work on Psychological Contract, which she is the primary investigator and proponent of. She is a professor at the Carnegie Mellon University and the Tepper School of Business, and she has been widely published in a number of areas and journals, even winning 2 Academy of Management George Terry Awards for the best management book, which is extremely impressive. So before we get into the reading, I guess a brief summary is in order.
And I just want to open with one of the key quotes from the reading. The tasks of a business school are to train men for the practice of management as a profession. And so the article by Herbert Simon was written at a time when the business school enterprise was facing difficulties and wrestling over its identity. The paper was published in 1967 and framed these challenges as a design problem relating to a business school's purpose, what the business school should teach to its students, and what type of faculty would be needed to fulfill the purpose. Regarding the subject matter, Simon laid out the foundation for what has become a long-standing discourse in education, the synthesis of practical relevance against academic rigor, which he embodied as a struggle between what is scientifically relevant versus what is practically useful. This point carried over to the discussion of the faculty, of whom Simon expressed concerns over a natural tendency to break into 2 opposing camps of scientists and practitioners who valued themselves differently, from the scholar's emphasis on publication to the practitioner's focus on field study and application of knowledge. Accompanying the article, and these are also available at our website, were the 2 commentaries published in 2012. One of them is by Rakesh Khurana and J.C. Spender that provided a broader history of business schools and places the Simon article in that history stream, lamenting how many of Simon's fears expressed in the 1967 article came true. Also, our special guest, Denise, has provided a commentary about Herbert Simon, the person, Herbert Simon, the individual, and also talks about where the field of business education should head if it is to overcome the rigor relevance challenge. And there's a lot of themes to explore in these papers, including extending them more broadly to education and other fields. Reading Herbert Simon, I was struck by how easily I could substitute professional military education for management education in the paper and not had to change anything else. Very similar challenges. And also, my doctoral program at George Washington spent a lot of time discussing the benefits and challenges of multidisciplinary education and the natural tensions inherent of being a scholar practitioner. So I look forward to the discussion.
So, Denise, you actually worked with Herbert Simon.
Oh, I think I couldn't say that I worked with him. I did lunch with him and had many meetings over the years. When I came as a full professor to Carnegie Mellon in the middle 1990s, and Herb was in the last decade of his life, but very active. And so we met on committees, and I would come and seek his counsel on a variety of questions. And I will say that we still talk about him at Carnegie Mellon as if he's sort of a moral center, a true north. His name comes up a lot in discussions of both how we should teach or what we want the future of our university to be.
So cool that you actually have a direct connection. And I think if you refer to him as Herb, I think that's a fair assessment that you have worked together. So I look forward to maybe like a couple of anecdotes or something throughout this discussion. That would be, I think, amazing. And our listeners would really
Absolutely. I will say the first thing that I noticed when I went to visit him, besides the fact that his office was the typical professor's pile upon pile of office, a huge, huge, huge room, was a big sign by the door that said, "Take off your computer glasses before you walk home." So he knew a lot about cognitive limits, just like the rest of us did. And I thought it was part of his wonderful humanity.
That's so interesting. It's almost like the, you know, the sign at the academy, at Plato's Academy, that those who did not study geometry should not enter, or something to that effect. I was just thinking in preparing for this episode that, as I mentioned in the introduction, we have been inadvertently building up to this for some time now, that we had, as part of the GMS season, we had discussions with Bill Starbuck and Andrew Pettigrew, who were explicitly touching upon these themes of what the business school has become and why this is functional or not as functional or good or bad. And then previously when Henry Mintzberg joined us, he kind of kicked off this this theme within our series of discussions about what it is that the business school is for, what it is as a thing, and where's the value in that. But now we have you to come and discuss this with us. So very, very exciting. Lots of themes to cover. One of the first things, and we ask everyone within this GMS project, is why did you write this paper? What was the inspiration and the motivation and the goals of producing this commentary?
Well, I was asked by the JMS editors to write it. Herb had passed away, and though some of the original 1967 authors were still alive, sadly he was not. But their question to me was, what do you think of the issues that he raised in 67, and how do they compare to issues today we face? And one question being, how might it be reflected in this new movement towards evidence-based management? And I was very eager to talk about it. And I have to say that one of the key ideas from Herb always was the notion of the need to rub scholarship and practice together. And he used the word rub repeatedly in the paper and in other contexts. So he sort of saw, what is it, a virtuous contact from either two different people or communities of people coming together, or research problems and practical problems being worked jointly. He didn't see an inevitable conflict, though he was well aware of the trajectories of values and interests that might take those domains and move them far away from each other.
I was just wondering about this idea of rubbing the theory and practice together, and about how it keeps sort of resurfacing in this debate about business education as such. And thinking about the article, Herbert, or shall I call him Herb?
Herb.
Herb.
His wife called him Herbert, but we'll call him Herb.
All right, so it's the other way around, that the Herbert is the more closer relationship form of addressing. All right. So one of the things that Herb mentioned in the article was about the sort of the agenda of the business schools and how they were established. And you addressed that as well, of course, in your article. And we've been there too. We started this podcast with two episodes, one on Taylor and one on Fayol. And they sort of presented two slightly different, I guess, philosophies of institutionalizing business as an education, where Taylor was looking for a more scientific, obviously, as is in the name, a way of tackling management and this more rigorous and systematic approach. Whereas Henri Fayol was taking what I think now might be described as more of a case study method, where he would be building on his experiences in executive positions to explain what the organization is like and what are some of the ways of dealing with that. So both of these themes interacted with practice, but in different ways. So Taylor, of course, looked at practice as a mode of study, where he would quantify and measure it, whereas Fayol seemed to consider it as more of an art. So we have this distinction in these two papers between art and, I think it was science? And I wonder if it's what you think about tracing these two back to the Taylor and Fayol distinction back in the day when business schools were actually being conceived of and established as a way of institutionalizing management as a profession.
Well, I think you're raising some very interesting fundamental questions. One thing I would add, and this comes from some of the work of Khurana, because he did a history of business schools, is that he made the point that the first business school in the United States, at any rate, which was Wharton, was founded on, with the notion of producing ethical business people who would be morally principled and would understand how values could become foundational to an organization for the benefit of society. But, people are often surprised that the roots of business school education were in the United States, the attempt to make a moral manager in the heyday of robber barons and tremendous labor industrial conflict. Interestingly, I think, as you pointed out, that we cycle back and forth through these issues. And I think that one of the key things, the difference between Fayol and Taylor, is Taylor was very grounded in the work that people did and understanding the organizational data and understanding how work was done and looking at the work and then based on that drawing insight or solving problems that could then produce more, we want to say, routinized solutions because they were somehow optimal. It wasn't about prizing the authority of the manager, whereas Fayol places much more esteem in the power and authority of the executive. In some respects, I think that that's a fundamental problem, a tension between any kind of more systematic approach, be it based on science or organizational data or the combination of the two, and the image of the manager as somehow this artful individual, somehow different from others, who, based on usually his experience, that person has insight that others lack and others can't necessarily even critique. So to my mind, that's one of the issues that Herb Simon would be very distressed by, because though he believed very much in the value of intuition, his notion of intuition was people who have, was the use of prior experiences that have been organized as mental models and schema, we would call them templates, that can be pulled from memory when the individual who is experienced and has developed these mental insights can quickly pull out a similar situation from the past and apply it, which is different from art. There's more a practice and feedback component to Herb's view, I believe, of intuition and executive decision-making, in contrast to Fayol.
Right. It's more something like reflective craft, isn't it?
Certainly the reflective component is there. I also think, Herb was one of the first people to talk about the issue, I believe, of the number of hours of practice that expertise required. And so the notion that you would be, as a manager, spending many, many years working in domains in which you would get feedback on what worked and what didn't, and you would go and you would talk to people and gather information and look at the organizational data as deficient or contaminated as it might be, and over time the templates in your recollection would be more accurate representation of processes that worked.
So essentially it's not this notion of the glorious leader that that people like Henry Mintzberg like to critique. Yeah.
So if I can, I'll tell you one little story that in order to write the paper about in the 40-year revisitation of the JMS, that JMS special issue, I went to the electronically to the CMU archives on Herbert Simon, which are available to anybody, and downloaded some of his, I looked at quite a number of his papers, but I also found his old syllabi. So his old descriptions of his classes. And they're fascinating because he, even in the 1960s, was renowned for teaching, treating students as if they were consultants. And he was going to be their client. And they were going to work on practical problems and articulate what their approach was and why they used that approach, and then test it out and come back and then in class and in a feedback process, reflect and be debriefed. And at the bottom of one of his syllabi from like 1964, it said something like, "And based on this, we're going to find out if you are managers or peasants."
I was wondering where that came from.
Yeah, got it.
Or why it's there in the first place. It was such an odd way to start start the article, because the opening passage of Denise's article on Herb's paper is exactly this quote that we'll find out whether you're a manager or a peasant. Like, why are we talking about peasants here?
That's a good question. As far as I know, Herb was born in Milwaukee, and I don't know if he ever met any peasants, but he did want to challenge people to deepen their knowledge and to become, as you say, the reflective practitioner. And somebody who doesn't assume always that you know. He was not a friend of overconfident people. And I will say that I did watch him many times in colloquia and whatnot, challenge and prick somebody's bubble. And you could watch somebody bleed to death without any blood as a function of the issues he would raise. So he did not tolerate fools or ill thought out ideas. He was tough.
Yeah, and I was also struck by the idea that business schools, you know, the fact that Wharton had started to try to bring up this the moral manager and the ethical dimension, because that's actually a kind of a similar cycle that we see in other professions of where, you know, the science and the practice, you know, they co-evolve and move forward. But every once in a while, you end up with, say, new ethical challenges that actually shake the foundation of what it means to be a professional. And then the profession has to go back and think about, well, all right, what are the ethical dimensions of both the science and the practice? And let's get back to sort of a moral foundation and get back to the values. And then, after a while, that sort of fades, and then you're back to handling matters of practice. Like, for example, when a profession has some sort of a big, moral crisis, like, you know, the robber barons that we mentioned before from the past, but say now you have, the financial crises, you have senior leader misconducts in the military and those sorts of things. The ethical dimension of what we have, of what we educate, can get lost in the shuffle or lost in the discussion if we're not careful. And then until it's too late and we have to bring it, and we have to physically put energy to bring it back. That's always been kind of bothersome to me in a way, because it just seems like something we just naturally forget.
Well, it's an interesting point, because I believe it was, I don't remember, it's Steve Barley's work, where he's looking at, over time, cycles in management books and in the media and whatnot. When are employees the most important asset that an organization has, and under what conditions is the business press talking about bet your company and the value of being able to lay off and reemploy people? And that seems to be every bit as cyclical as our ethics cycle as well. When the economy is booming, employees are very important because firms are really trying hard to get them. And when the economy is not doing so well, employees are expendable and financial issues dominate. So that kind of rhetoric has been with us quite a number of decades. I would think that one of the issues that becomes then important, certainly in business school education, is for us to be very sensitive to how people are framing the problem. What problem are you trying to solve? And who are the stakeholders of that problem? And we're very, in an age of where media being so salient and dominant, very, vulnerable to taking on the focus of whatever emotional tone or hype is prevalent. And Herb would say, this is the problem of being it's the problem of being a human being. We have cognitive limits. We have great flexibility, but we're not aware of all the things that affect our decision making, and we use far less of the information available to us than is there that could eventually help us make a good decision. So the fundamental problem then is, how do we become more reflective and find ways of debiasing ourselves from this kind of overreaction to external pressures or overreactions to rhetoric? And that's part of the professional's training, is to create that sort of internal compass.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Because as you were talking, the in times of downsizing, the financial decisions become more salient. And as one of the things that we talk a lot about as we within the U.S. government are looking at stronger fiscal pressures. This is actually a time when the profession should be reorienting itself towards more innovation. This is how you should overcome it. But then the fiscal pressures make that so difficult, because you're making decisions one way when you're espousing another.
Well, I would extend that from beyond the financial decisions to also technological obsessions, for lack of better words, because now that we had the latest period of difficulty for business, one of the main things that emerged out of this is this new reincarnation of scientific management, which is algorithmic management, very much deprioritizing individuals as human beings and taking us back, circumventing most of human relations theory, to the time of Taylor, where we quantify to the most minute details, and then we compare that against pre-existing benchmarks. So, the cycle of human versus technical is certainly alive and well, as you just mentioned.
Yeah, well, one thing perhaps you could call attention to your listeners is one of Herb's last books. Well, he edited some of his books over and over so many times so that they are always kind of new. But he wrote a book called The Science of the Artificial. And what he was talking about there was the fact that organizational studies is a study of something that's man-made. That's what he meant by artificial. And when something's invented by people, like organizations and society, it's a little different than, say, the science of the natural world or the physical sciences. It's a little bit, maybe a little bit more like engineering or architecture, because both of those fields focus on things that people make or design and build. And the idea that if you're doing engineering, engineers have to attend to a lot of different stakeholders. I mean, it's not just enough that there's enough money to put up the building. It's got to be able to be robust. It's got design properties. It has users. It has a public, and may also have a lifespan that has to be thought about and planned into it. And one of the issues in the science of the artificial is, how do you reflect in the work of organizational research and organizational practice the stakeholders that anything that's man-made must have?
Yeah, and even beyond that, that if something is man-made, so by this artificial definition, it still has some property of being reified in some way. But organizations are man-imagined, so it's even beyond that. There's constantly tell my students that organizations don't exist. You can't find one or point to it, and it's very much subject to how we think about them or how we imagine and conceptualize them. So it's even far more shaky than the distinction between creation and something that exists naturally that could be analyzed. And I think this feeds well into this discussion that we've been kind of circling around about the moral value and moral aspirations that management as a profession had, at least early on. And I wanted to say there, just listening to both you and Tom talk about this, that I think a lot of this depends on what these early management scholars and researchers and teachers understood to be as the morality of management. What is the moral purpose of managing other individuals kind of getting them to do things for the benefit of this imagined entity that is the organization that does nonetheless produce very tangible outcomes in form of products and monetary exchanges and so on and so forth. And I was thinking that this idea of management as a profession that is ethical and moral does very much depend on what it is that we think managers should do and who they should do it for. And thinking of the early management, I think it's quite significant to mention that the who is it for was a very limited idea, I think mainly summarized by the shareholder approach, essentially, that it's to do with the owners and the efficiency. And Hall Taylor's thing was that he believed to be doing workers a huge favor and huge service by injecting these scientific principles into the workplace, because that would minimize waste and get them to be more effective and more efficient, and thus not waste their time at the factory. But of course, in practice, that worked out slightly differently.
But importantly, also, I think one of the things that to be said about Taylor is he was not confident that managers were actually very effective at what they were doing. And part of the issue was to design work in a way so that even managers couldn't mess it up. The idea that then the worker is in a position to do his or her best, and managers there to support, not necessarily to direct. And of course, a lot of the reason why the classic scientific management approach hasn't been consistently implemented has because of the issues of authority in the organization.
Right, but Herb does a lot of the same, and the Carnegie Mellon tradition do a lot of the same in terms of the emphasis on routines and the standard operating procedures as per their vocabulary, and this idea of the interaction of organization and individual via cognition, as opposed to embodied experience of some sort. So that has a lot of the same themes there as well.
I think I wouldn't label the approach in Herb's work in administrative behavior and in the science of the artificial as promoting routines. It was really promoting learning and reflective practice. Sometimes then it would be circumstances would be such that there might actually be a routine that at least at present looks like if we follow this process over and over, it's going to give us an optimal result, and the people using this practice will deepen their understanding of how to make it work. But one of the points I think that he was very well aware of how much uncertainty there was in the world, and that many kinds of work and certainly many managerial jobs involve a high degree of risk and change in the environment. And that's not a circumstance in which routine practices necessarily fit well. But I think he would say there are processes whereby the individual who's trying to deal with a novel situation or a crisis situation might be better able to figure out what to do. So I if you might let me it relates, but it's a digression. Well, there's a lot of attention was given at one time to something that our erstwhile Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld said when he talked years ago about unknown unknowns, known unknowns, and known knowns. And that turns out to be an old categorization used in the 1950s in the federal government in the United States to talk about different classes of problems. And you need routines. You can benefit from routines like checklists in routine processes in medicine when there's a well-established understanding of what's going on in a medical case or in a repeated decision involving purchasing or whatnot. We could call that a known known. On the other hand, there are a lot of other circumstances in which this problem maybe has happened somewhere else, but it hasn't happened to us. So it's a known unknown. We know, we don't know it, but somebody else might. And in that case, you use a different process for gathering information to find an effective solution to the problem. It's the way a lot of meetings are run. A lot of meetings are based on known unknowns. If we get everybody together, maybe we can figure out what's going on. I know that myself, as the one person calling the meeting, doesn't have all the information. Then the last situation is the unknown unknown. This has never happened before. You know, the idea, you know, when the iPhone first came out, geez, never had one of these. What could it do? That leads to a much more improvisational course of action as people try to figure out what to deal with how to deal with a novel situation or how to deal with the surprising event of a big technological change. And I think that Herb was very attentive to decision processes and how managers and others would practice mindfully to recognize what kind of situation am I dealing with? Can I pull insight from my prior experience, that template in my memory? Or do I need to use a process for gathering information or for learning by doing?
I'd like to bring out a point too that, you know, kind of tying the thread of the moral purpose of management to say the management of the domain of knowledge, which was included in Herb Simon's paper. This gets very much to what you're just talking about, Denise. You know, a lot of times when we talk about moral, our first pictures in mind goes to somewhat of the intangibles of how individuals behave, but there's definitely a moral dimension to the domain of knowledge in which a profession essentially charters itself to manage. And so when we talk about reflective practice, as an individual professional make a judgment about, you know, a situation, how I perceive the situation, how I frame the solution, what have you, there's a moral dimension that says that I should be sharing this with the profession, with the rest of the professional community, in order to help others approach, you know, help them build frames of reference for things that are unknown to them, but could very well be presented to them in their professional work. And so I was just kind of struck by that, because this is one of the challenges in which we face, say, in doing professional education for our senior military leaders, is that we're presenting, you know, we have to give them tools to help them reflect and be prepared to face unknown situations, what is unknown to them individually, but is known to the community, if you will.
Right. So I think that's part of this idea in recognizing bounded rationality. It's that we're trying to be more mindful in the sense of creating a logic or an understanding of what's going on, but we can't do it ourselves always as individuals. And one of the issues is it's very hard for people, for any of us as individuals, to de-bias ourselves. As Daniel Kahneman said, who was, of course, doing all this work over many years on cognitive biases, he says he's been studying them for 44 years and he still falls for every one of them. But as do we all, the key idea is, though we can't see our own biases, but when we talk to another person and he or she says something framed in a kind of strange way, we can see that other person's bias. So in organizations, you can have processes that help de-bias the individual. So as a function of those processes, you get a better quality decision. And then is one of the issues, that's one of the insights behind the processes that are called decision repairs, like having a peer review of a decision or having new ideas submitted to a kind of a jury of your peers to get feedback as a way of broadening the frame of reference. And also, from an ethical point of view, perhaps broadening attention to more stakeholders than the individuals who came up with the idea at first might have been able to think of on their own.
Well, this does seem to reinforce significantly the notion that we addressed just before about management and organizations as being, you know, something that is not there, that is a product of people essentially agreeing on a certain point of view. Because the extent of decision-making corrections that goes on in natural sciences is to do with methods and qualifications of methods with regards to what is being researched or understood. In management, however, it's to do with the facts of the world, basically. It's a very ontologically centered process of building up the reality that is then being acted upon. And with that regard, when we talk about morality, and Tom, what you were saying about certain decisions to qualify as moral, I think that's very shaky ground to put such a hefty concept of morality and ethics on. Because if what we're talking about is essentially something that people agree upon, the morality of it is again subject to their agreement and to agreement of their peers. So with that respect, can management even make claims to morality or ethics of any sort, at least traditionally understood?
I would think one of the big issues is the attention to stakeholders. And the stakeholders are not necessarily the obvious ones of shareholders only, or even employees, though as critical as that is. But part of the issue in making a decision, the kind of decision not only that addresses the immediate consequences or goals, but also achieves some long-term value, which is, I think, what we're talking about when we talk about morality, is broadening the frame of who are the stakeholders who are affected. So what then is the decision we are making? The idea of the assumptions that go into the decision is very much part of the discussion on unbounded rationality, of exploring the politics and the way in which a decision is framed. And I think one of the reasons why Herb talked a lot about rubbing practice and scholarship together was his was a sort of vision, I believe, that in the business school, you would have clinical faculty who are practitioners, and you would have scholars who are researchers, and that they would teach together, that they would develop teaching materials together, and that students would be in the rubbing together of practice and scholarship. Students would see the different potentials, the frames of reference, the focus, the big picture issues, the practical mechanics, and become more in tune with how to make decisions that would have, on the whole, positive consequences, because all decisions are in some way consequential. But also to acknowledge that many of the decisions we make, we will not know what the consequences are, because most managers don't get a lot of feedback on whether what they did worked for a variety of stakeholders or not. They go on to the next decision. So if you're not getting a lot of feedback, the process you use in making the decision becomes even more important, because that's basically where the quality comes from, not necessarily from a feedback cycle that lets you improve your process over time.
I'm wondering, do you know if Herb hierarchically ordered maybe them in some way, that say that the scholar in the pair would be sort of making a commentary on how the experiences of the practitioner fit within the grand scheme of things, or what would be the balance of emphasis between the two?
The one thing that I think he felt was important, he didn't want the scholar to have to work on practical problems, that wasn't the focus. He said scholars should work on what scholars think is important and interesting, but if they do that well and they're aware of problems of practice, the spillover will occur. He really wanted the research to be what the scholar felt was important. But in the classroom, I think the idea that you would work practical problems from kind of a scholar's point of view, from principles, from frameworks, I think became very important. But recognizing that the scholar himself or herself isn't the best person to present the practical problem, because we weren't usually extrapolating from it to fit our framework. So a lot of the materials that he had in his archive were involved presenters coming into class and talking about their issues, or students going out, interviewing people in companies, and then coming back and talking about what they learned. That the student should be gathering information to learn how to be a good diagnostician.
Well, it's I think Davide Nicolini keeps saying that business schools are unique in universities in that they don't generate any knowledge. They just borrow stuff from everyone else.
Aren't we all standing on the shoulders of giants?
Right. Yes. I don't necessarily agree with that, but I mean, he has a point, right? So, and Herb's papers and even your commentary, they do touch upon this as well. And I think hence this issue of developing the different kinds of knowledge that a business school should operate with. So, the actionable knowledge and then the kind of the purer scientific knowledge about the issues of interest and things like that. It's not as, at least, I mean, I don't know much about what's happening outside the business school.
I think the idea of actionable knowledge and scholarly knowledge seems to me a little bogus, but maybe the way to talk about it would be knowing what versus knowing how. I think one of the issues is if we go from a point of view, we say, we have now 130 years of research that relates to things that are business, that are part of the domain of the business school. Or I should say, as a psychologist, at least since Hugo Munsterberg in the 19-teens, we have research that relates to the kinds of problems that my students would deal with in a business school. So that's 100 years, that there are generalizable principles that might have to do with basic managerial work like selecting employees or finding appropriate rewards or working with people to redesign a job or share information. We know stuff that we know what, some general principles. The issue is that in business schools, the quality of the practice that would lead to knowing how is a little sketchy. And I think the interesting aspect of looking at business school training is in contrast to so many other areas from medicine and engineering, is that our students leave, unless they've had a lot of experience before they came to the business school, they actually leave not as experts, not as novices, but maybe somewhere in the middle, like intermediately knowledgeable people about managerial domains. And if you think about the process of going from a novice to an expert, a novice knows some general information, but they can't really adapt it to new situations. An intermediate, somebody who's practiced for a while, understands the principles and has started to see how they can be adapted to different circumstances, whereas an expert knows both how to adapt the principle as well as how to actually create new information and insight and solve problems in the context of their practice. I don't think our students get anywhere close to expertise, not like a resident in medicine might develop, because the quality of practice is small, is low, and the wide variation on how much know what is really taught. A lot of business schools, I think, teach too much craft knowledge. Here's how you do it. But that's kind of like in the military, generals preparing, fighting the battle of the last war, as opposed to the environment our students are going to go in and be in for 20 or 30 years. I doubt very much we can tell them today what to do 20 or 30 years from now. But we could help them understand the principles of the area that we're working in, from management or finance or whatnot, so they can adapt them when they get to the experiences they will have. And helping them adapt from science to practice strikes me as one of the things we should work on.
I think you're 100% right there. And thinking of the analogy with the med schools, I think the reason why one of the reasons why they're kind of more successful at generating professionals than business schools are is because the idea of knowledge what is intimately related and tied to the knowledge how, whereas that's not the case in business school education. And arguably, at least from a process perspective, one would be hard-pressed to justify how knowledge what without knowledge how can even be a thing.
I think that's a very good point, especially since we're not training them to be scientists to test theory. We're training them to build on knowledge bases from research, from managerial experience in order to be able to adapt it for themselves. But are we really helping them adapt it in the way we teach? I think that's a fundamental question and our opportunity.
And that's all for part one of episode 29. Thank you so much for listening. We hope you're enjoying this discussion. And if you are, please share this episode and the podcast with your friends, colleagues, and students. Please join us next week as we finish the discussion with Denise Rousseau on Herbert Simon's Journal of Management Studies classic, here on Talking About Organizations.